because it's gonna take a little while to get into the groove, you know.
Yeah. We'll just talk for a little bit. We'll hit our stride and just keep talking. And wherever we intro is where we intro.
Fix it in post.
We can't fix everything in post.
Yeah, we can.
Can't fix Cody at all. Oh. Yeah, that was just said. I did have some ideas for, topics though. I like literally was thinking about them on the drive here. So I was kind of blowing it today. Nothing for really an intro. but I did have a couple of ideas and topics we can go over. One of them, well, what about you guys? Did you? Oh, that's getting kind of crispy.
Are you good?
Yeah, that's good. No.
What about you guys? Do you guys think of anything throughout your busy day today?
You know, not really.
I have a job. I was doing my job. I'm assuming Ryan was doing his job too.
I was doing my self-employment operation kind of. Today was pretty good. Today was relatively productive. I did try to learn how to front flip for about 2 hours.
Really?
Yeah. So that was interesting. I didn't get too far with it. I still need to practice. There's a big mental barrier.
Like from a platform or
from the ground.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And you didn't have any padding or anything?
I folded up a comforter and I put that on the ground. Oh. But the problem is that even with that, it would be kind of cool to do it on a trampoline, cuz I used to be able to do crazy stuff on trampolines when I was younger and more agile. I can't really say that I'm like 21, but when I was younger and my bones were more flexible, I would do crazy stuff on trampolines. I could, at one point, if I had like some friends that would bounce me, because you know how you can do like, you can build up a bounce if you jump at the right time.
Yeah.
I used to be able to pretty consistently land double backflips.
Wow.
Like double backflips.
Holy smokes.
With the right buildup. Single backflips and no further if there wasn't a buildup.
Yeah.
Otherwise, because backflips are a little sketchy, because front flips, you can tuck your head down. And so your chances of like breaking your 11-year-old neck is not as much with a front flip, but with a back flip, if you overshoot, you can really easily twist your noggin the wrong way. You don't want to be doing that.
I've always found it easier to do a back flip on a trampoline than a front flip.
Really?
Yeah.
I remember the front flips are always way like less scary.
Huh.
We used to spend a lot of time with my little trampoline. We spent a lot of time out there, like me and my distant step siblings and my little brother. We would go out and have like a good time and jump on the tramp.
Yeah,
like a,
do you know that they called it a jumpaline before your mom got on one?
Oh wow.
You guys have the same mom, and I respect her, so I redact that.
So are you talking about one of those like little 3-foot trampolines?
No, it's like a
full-on trampoline,
like a real one.
Oh, okay.
I remember I was pretty fortunate in the trampoline game. At my mom's, we had one, and it was like a small, I don't know what you measured, it's like 12 foot, I don't know.
Yeah, I know what
you're talking
about.
It was a smaller full-size trampoline.
Right,
yeah.
And then at my dad's, he found one at like a garage sale one time, and that thing was like a pumped trampoline. That thing was like on steroids, and it was bigger, and the springs were like much gooder. I think that the one that we had at my mom's was like a watered down lame trampoline, so it wasn't quite as good for stunting. So my trampoline of choice was at my dad's, and that was where I could get like the double backflips going.
Man, sweet.
Yeah, you guys have one, don't you? Here.
Yeah.
Did these trampolines have like the net around them, or is it just not safe?
So at first we didn't have the net on the trampoline at my mom's. And then we ended up putting it on for reasons. So it's kind of funny. So like we were jumping on it, and then like my stepbrother, my long lost stepbrother, who I still keep in contact with, Jarrett, we were like jumping, and then he shoved his leg in between two of the springs.
Oh no.
Like up to his crotch.
Oh no.
And he was like, and his leg was just all the way jammed in between the springs. The springs were all like stretched out. So we had to like pull the springs and get his leg.
Oh no.
And then we put on the guard and the net, which we had.
Yeah.
And they have to put on like the bars and stuff. But my dad's never had that, and we just didn't screw up, and we were fine. It kept you on edge, you know?
Yeah.
Right. Sometimes that danger is what you need. Sometimes you need that little bit of danger.
It's like turning traction control off.
Yeah. Right. Oh,
oh yeah.
Dude. Traction control is...
for the weak is what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I I really love driving with no traction control on. It's an experience.
It's a
freeing
experience.
Oh yeah, exactly.
And your car makes enough jam to when you turn it off, you're gonna know it's off.
Yeah, oh yeah, you can break loose.
I would hope, with a 370 with like an exhaust and an intake.
Yeah, well, and I have those wider tires too, so my.
Oh, and it still breaks loose.
Oh yeah.
Oh, beautiful.
Oh yeah. Well, especially when it's wet.
Yeah.
What's really cool is that those 350Zs and the 370Zs, that Nissan rear end that comes in those, I think that they might be different between those two, but the 350Z for sure, that's like one of the most indestructible drifting rear differentials. There are guys that build like crazy drift cars, and they take those 350Z rear diffs and they use those because like you cannot break them.
Interesting.
Yeah. They're like you can just shred tires all day on a drift track. And, like, you'll never have an issue with that rear end. My buddy Daniel told me that, and I'm believing him, although I don't know, like, personally, I've never built a drift car. But apparently those, the 350Z rear ends, probably the 370s are the same. You'll never have a problem with that rear end. You're gonna break other things before you break that, you know?
Right, right. So, I'm not familiar with the 350Zs, but I know with the 370, there's, if you get the sport package, there's a limited slip differential.
Oh yeah.
And with the, if you don't have the sport package, you just get a regular differential.
Open differential.
Yeah.
Now what do you have?
I've just got the open, unfortunately.
So does it one wheel peel?
I'm
really surprised that the standard 370 or 350 would have an open diff, because people drift the piss out of them.
Right.
And I wouldn't assume that they're all the sports package.
No. Yeah. It's weird. I'm not sure why they made that decision, but probably money.
Yeah, and it is. Like limited slip differentials. I know them in the Honda world, which I like Hondas, which is kind of lame. It's kind of like liking Glocks. It's like
right
boring.
Yeah,
but in the Honda, they're all
bikes.
What's that?
Not when it comes to bikes.
Not when it comes to bikes, but Honda makes everything. That's kind of what I like about them.
Yeah.
But
they're reliable.
Incredibly reliable, incredibly standardized. We were using that word last night. All their stuff is very, like, building Honda cars is really, really cheap. Like, I bought from this kid in Gig Harbor, I bought, like, out of a Prelude, an H22 A4 engine, transmission, wiring harness. Like, his dad bought him this Prelude, and then he crashed it. And I bought the entire drivetrain out of the car for like $500, like transmission, engine, running engine.
No way.
Oh yeah, radiator, like all the stuff.
Yeah.
It was Hondas are really, really cheap. That's the beauty of them.
Yeah.
If you can deal with them being front wheel drive or wrong wheel drive.
Yeah, that's not quite as fun.
It's not quite as fun. But with a Honda, you're never gonna drift it. You can actually do like a lot of guys do all wheel drive conversions. And but the problem is that the parts to do that are basically what you do is you take the drivetrain parts out of like a CRV. There's like the four wheel drive CRVs.
Okay.
And I believe it's a CRVs. And then you use the rear end components for the it's a CRV. That's a CRV, yes. Just had to double check myself. I don't wanna misinform anyone that might do this. But you can use the rear drivetrain components out of that. And it'll go, like, under an EF Civic. It'll go under a CRX. It'll go, I think with a bunch of modifications, you can put it under EGs, like EG Civics. So, like, 93 to 96 or whatever those were. Probably wrong in those years. Or 92 to 96. And then you have, like, the sickest car ever. You basically have a Subaru with a good engine.
Right.
Not a Subaru engine.
Right.
Sorry to anyone who likes Subarus, but that's my gripe with them is their engines. The rest of the car is really awesome.
Would Subarus go through, what, like a quart of oil a day? That's kind of standard.
Well, the problem with the Subaru engines on top is that they're a boxer engine.
Yeah.
So whereas a Honda engine or like the engine, yours is a V6, so it's a little different. But it's a...
Yeah, baby.
You get the... God, what are those called?
VQ,
yes.
Yeah.
The ass trumpets.
Yeah, the exhaust tone on those bad boys, not ideal, but, you know, they make power.
They do make power. They do make power. But the problem with the Subarus primarily is what I don't like about the boxer engines. The boxer engines are cool because they're post four, so they sit really low in the car. You don't have like a valve cover and a head sticking up right against your hood.
Right. Yeah.
You have like they're down low, so it keeps the center of gravity really low.
Right.
Which is really great for like cornering and
rally.
Totally rally, totally autocross, like time attack. Going around corners, that low center of gravity is like fantastic. Paired with the all-wheel drive is really good. But the problem is that they're, in my opinion, they're just not super built to last. You know, they basically glue together. Like they encapsulate the crank with like two halves, and then then there's like the cylinders and then the heads. They're weird. There's a lot of parts and they all sandwich together. So you have a lot of places for them to leak. Whereas on like your standard like block style engine, you have like your block, which holds your crank and has your cylinders, and then your girdle or your main caps hold the crank. And there's like way less places for anything to leak, and it's all overall technically stronger. But one of the main problems is just like they always lose head gaskets, and lubrication, like the splash lubrication factor of the boxer style engines are not as good. They just don't splash lube quite as well, if I'm not mistaken. I think that's part of it. So they do sometimes tend to burn oil sooner and score up sooner.
Gotcha.
Whereas, I don't know, you can look at a Toyota engine, like, I don't know what that engine was it's like the little 1.8 or 2 liter that they use in their cars forever. And it's just like a super basic, like a Honda D series in a Toyota. And they just go forever and ever and ever and ever. And they make power up until they like burn so much oil that you get rid of the car.
Yeah. I was reading something once where somebody was like, oh yeah, we'll just buy a cheap Honda. We'll throw a brick on the accelerator in neutral and just wait till it blows up. And then they sat there
3 hours later.
Yeah. And then it like never blew up. They just had to give up because it just never blew up.
Yeah. Honda makes like bulletproof motors.
Yeah. It's crazy.
It's the same with the CBR 600 F4i. You can redline it for hours and you're going to be fine and dandy.
Now the F4i, that's more of a stunt bike, am I mistaken?
Yeah, so it has more power on the low end than like a double R. It's got a bigger sprocket on the back, so
better for those bigger sprocket in the back, better for those woolies, low speed maneuvers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So is that like a higher? Is it the same? Not the same engine that's in the double R.
Correct. I think they're.
It could be. It could be maybe the same, like the same crankshaft and the same bore and the same stroke. Like it could. The parts could interchange, but they can always change things with like the cam profiles. That's a big thing. Is you can totally change.
Right.
You can totally change the way a four-stroke engine runs by changing the cam profiles.
Yeah.
Like valve. Not valve angles, but like valve sizes, which that would kind of involve modifying the head a whole bunch to fit different size valves. But you can take like, there's examples of that. I can't think of a great example, but like the Chevy 350, like the old school like hot rod V8 that people would build, and same as like I think it's like the Ford 351. I probably sound like an idiot. I don't know anything about domestic stuff.
Yeah,
but you can totally change. You can take an engine out of like a Chevy van. And it's the same block and everything, and with better heads and better cams and more suitable valve train components, you can make it make like enormous amounts of horsepower and put it in like a car, and it's the same block and everything. So, I mean, for small blocks and stuff like that, it's this. You can totally change the way an engine is just by changing like small components,
yeah.
And it all adds up to like so. That might be the difference between the F4i. Is that what it's called?
Yep.
And the RR, maybe it's just like different cam profile, different tune.
Right. So the
tune is huge.
Yeah, the double R is big on like high end speed,
mm-hmm.
But not for low end power.
And on motorcycles, you have the gearing aspect of it.
Right.
Which on motorcycles is like easy to change. On cars, it's not as easy to change. You have to change out like ring gears.
Yeah.
And stuff like that, or tire sizes. Which ring gears are, if you're actually trying to like increase your top speed or make your one and two gears like work better for what you're doing, changing your ring gears is like what you have to do in a car, and that's like hundreds of dollars, and you're tearing your rear end apart. Or if it's like an all-wheel drive car, I think you're tearing multiple things apart.
Right.
But on bikes, it's like 30 minutes you change sprockets.
Yeah.
And throw an extra link or two on the chain or take a link out.
Takes like two tools maybe.
Oh, yeah. Maybe three.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that changing your gearing on a motorcycle was so easy.
Very easy.
I mean, pretty much everything on a bike is easy. Yeah. You don't really have to lift up a bike to get to the vitals.
Right, that's mm-hmm. true. Everything's kind of right there.
Working on bikes is so. That's what I learned to work on stuff on is two-stroke bikes.
Yeah.
Like that was my foundation for learning like the whole wrenching thing, and yeah, gearing is big on bikes because like if you're stunting like in street bike world, which I'm not familiar with, if you're stunting versus like commuting the bike or riding,
right.
You know, 80-ish miles an hour consistently or plus. Then
or
you're gonna,
plus, yeah.
Or plus. Not that Cody would ever do that on his.
So if you're stunting, you want a lower gear ratio, correct?
Typically, yeah. It would be a lower gear ratio, and what that would typically entail would be actually, so if you're talking about a gear ratio, I believe the number would be higher. I could be wrong. I could have it backwards. But it would be quote-unquote lower gearing. So, for example, in the off-road dirt bike world, if you're going to be riding trails, you typically want to put on a larger rear sprocket or a smaller front sprocket, either or. For example, a lot of the Japanese bikes are 13-tooth front, 50-tooth rear. That's very standard for a lot of Japanese bikes. And on my CR, I have a 13-tooth front, 52-tooth rear. And it makes it brings the gearing down, especially on a motocross bike. Motocross bikes are more geared in the transmission to fly around a track all day.
Right.
And not be, you know, do like tight technical crawling around roots in the woods.
Yeah.
So by changing that, it totally changes the way the bike behaves. You do lose top speed. That's kind of the trade-off.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're going to go to the dunes, you throw on like a 49-tooth rear sprocket and you're hauling absolute ass over sand dunes.
Right. Yeah.
And that's more suited for that.
So would like the 52-tooth would like kind of dig into the sand a little too much or
not so much? You're just gonna lose top speed. That's all it is.
I see.
And when you're on the sand, you are like you're pinned in fifth gear, like just to get from point A to point B.
Okay. And you have those like big like paddle tires.
Oh right? Yeah, I got a Sandstar paddle tire for my CR. It was very expensive. But it's one of like it's ultra scoopy. It has like the paddles are like probably. At least 3 inches tall.
Okay.
Off. It's just a smooth tire with these. It's probably got nine paddles on it, 9 or 10 big paddles, and it's really cool. Like when if you take a picture of a bike like roosting, with a paddle tire, the ploofs of sand that it throws off are like in waves, from each individual.
Sure.
It's like wave, and like this pattern off the tire.
Like a sprinkler or something.
Kinda.
Like,
yeah. Yep. Yeah. Exactly like that. So. Yeah, otherwise, if you, like, I think I air down my front dirt tire, and that works good enough, but you can also get, like, a special smooth sand tire that, a lot of time they're smooth and they have a couple, at least on ATVs, they're smooth and they have a couple, like, ridges to help, like, track, because sand is so weird to ride on. It's incredibly high traction and incredibly low traction at the same time.
Yeah.
Like, when you're hauling ass and you let off the throttle, you stop, like, really, really quick.
Because
you sink
like
into
sink
it,
in. Yeah.
But when you're taking off, you literally have to rev up to half your RPM range and dump the clutch just to take off, or else you there's like an art to taking off in sand, because if you just like try to slowly take off, you just dig in, and you sink your tire and you just like fall into the sand, so you kind of have to just like to even take off, you have to like romp the piss out of your bike or your quad to get out of the to even get moving, and then once you're moving, it's beautiful. Winchester Bay is a great place. As is Florence.
Oregon?
Yep.
Yeah.
Not actually Florence, Italy.
Oh, right.
Yeah. No,
underwater.
Yeah. In the what are those, aqueducts?
Yeah.
What are canals?
Canals. Canals, yes. But no, it's a good time. It's especially dunes are really fun. If you have the budget to go ride them, because it's kind of a drive. They're really fun, especially what happens is we call it the glass phenomenon. Like, oh, we're gonna get up early in the morning and go hit some glass. Because what'll happen is when it's like, you know, really dry, like heat of the summer, in the sand dunes, or kind of like on any beach that people ride on, it'll get really rutted out, and you'll get all these like people's tracks. You know,
right.
It upsets the sand.
Not what you want.
Not what you want. You're going through it, and it's real bumpy, and it's you're going through these tracks, and you're kind of your handlebars are jumping around. On a bike, it can get really sketchy. But if it's really dry out and it's really windy out, every night the wind blows and everything glasses over. It's like you shake the Etch-a-Sketch.
It gets all smooth. Yeah.
Yep. You shake the Etch-a-Sketch every night, and then you get out there in the morning. We call it dawn patrol, or hitting the glass.
Okay.
And you'd go out and like first thing in the morning, it was just like it's ultra buttery, and it's just you have it all to yourself, and it's like super super nice.
So it's kind of like getting the pow.
It's
like
exactly like
yeah.
getting the pow. Yeah. It's exactly the same as getting the pow. It's prime conditions.
Do you snowboard much?
I don't. And I know a lot of people that do, and it sounds really fun. It sounds like something I would be into. I know a ton of people who do, and I get invited all the time. Not all the time. I'm not that popular. But I get invited relatively frequently, especially when I went to school in Yakima, because we had White's Pass, like pretty close to Yakima. And so I got invited once in a while, but I did a long time ago when I was like a little kid, and it's just never been my thing, you know?
Yeah, it's never really been anything that I've gotten into either. I'm not sure why. It seems so silly when we're so close to like the ridge and all that stuff.
Oh yeah.
But you know, you can't do everything.
This is one of the only places, you know, where we live on the peninsula, on this particular part of the peninsula. It's one of the only places you can go surfing, go ride dirt bikes in the hills, and go snowboarding or skiing all on the same day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're all within 30 miles of each other.
Yep.
So that's kind of a, although it is kind of a, I don't know, it's a weird area.
Yeah. You could also, you could go, what is it? Water skiing.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Head out to the lake. Yeah. Head out to the lake. Go water skiing, wakeboarding, all that good stuff.
Yeah.
The triathlon, but with four.
Quadrathlon.
Quadrathlon.
We should do that sometime.
That would be fun.
You guys got to get bikes first.
Yeah.
Yeah, some dirt bikes.
Or we can just skip that part, but that's my favorite part. I don't know how to ski or snowboard, but I can ride a bike.
Yeah.
Actually, I have to fix my bike. There's shit fucked up with it.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, that's a Cody thing.
Yeah.
You've done other board sports before though, right? Like skateboarding? And
No, never skateboarded.
Interesting.
I was into skateboarding growing up. I thought it was cool. I used to watch a lot of
like Thrasher and whatnot.
No, not. It was actually Thrasher was around, but it wasn't like I didn't know of it. But when I was like young, I used to watch like on MTV. There would be like skateboarding stuff like way back in the day, like what was that? Like the guy off of that Rob Dyrdek.
Oh,
Robin
yeah.
Big.
Yeah. Robin Big.
I used
oh
to watch
gosh.
A lot of Robin Big, and I used
BB.
To. Yeah, oh yeah. I used to, oh yes, that's freaking brings it all back. And I used to watch a lot of, like, Viva La Bam, and they used to always skateboard, and I was like, oh, it looks so cool. But, I've never lived in a city, or, like, remotely close to where I could go, like, skate if I wanted to.
Yeah.
So I always rode dirt bikes.
You know, Tony Hawk is one of the most unrecognized people.
Oh my
famous
god!
People
yeah,
on his, the face of the planet.
His Twitter is amazing. He go like you've seen his tweets when he's like he goes out to eat and someone looks at his card or something and it's like, oh, Anthony Hawk, huh? Are you related to that Tony Hawk guy?
And he's like,
no, not
not
really.
At all.
Yeah, who's that?
Yeah, he's like probably in his 50s, right?
Yeah, and he still boards too.
Yeah, he's really
still skates.
He's the most prominent figure. He's like the, he's like, you know, he's the guy of skateboarding. I don't know anything about skateboarding, to be honest with you.
Yeah,
right. I mean, there's young blood that's kind of moving up in the skateboarding scene. As far as like tricks, like small tricks go, you know, ground tricks, people can blow Tony Hawk out of the water nowadays. Just with like street skating.
Right.
But,
yeah.
But Tony Hawk on like big air skating, you know, he's
he does crazy stuff.
Yeah, but that's how like most things are, is like the pioneers lay the groundwork for everyone else to come up and, you know, really show what can be done.
Yeah, I mean, Tony Hawk had to, like, invent all these tricks that people are learning now.
Right.
You know, he literally had to invent them. It's totally crazy.
Big part of it, too, might be, like, technology and how the actual skateboarding technology has gotten better.
That's true.
It probably hasn't changed a whole lot. But if you have, like, better wheels that are, like, a better compound than they used to be back in the 80s when he was probably pioneering all that, better, 80s or 90s.
Better bearings.
Better bearings, better trucks.
Trucks.
That's the extent of my skateboarding knowledge.
Yeah.
The deck also is another component.
I also think grip tape is probably a pretty big component that gets overlooked. Like,
I think we've named every component of the skateboard.
Just about. You know, you got your hardware too, so just regular old nuts and bolts, but I don't see how that can change much.
Yeah. Nuts and bolts are nuts and bolts.
Make them out of titanium.
Yeah.
Lightweight.
Oh, well, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure that's probably been done. But yeah, no, like a big thing too is like the guys that were really good at riding motorcycles in like the 70s. What was that guy's name? He rode the Honda Elsinores right when they came out. I can't think of his name, but he was like a Steve McQueen type, like big racing guy.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah.
Steve McQueen also rode a lot too, I believe, and he rode for Honda. But bikes have just gotten so much better, like massive changes. Like old bikes were like, not monoshock, but like dual shock, not like the PlayStation controller.
Right.
They were just like clunky, horrible 1970s suspension and 1970s engine design. And now they're just like a whole nother animal, and guys are getting so good on them because that's what they're used to. They're not used to like clunky old garbage.
Mm-hmm.
So I think with anything, just as time goes on, it's easier to, as like technology of a certain aspect, like increases and gets better, it's probably just easier to pick stuff up and get good at it.
Sure.
Because more user friendly.
Right. And now, like, you can go on YouTube and find tutorials for how to do all of these things.
Right.
So the information is all out there.
It's a great age to want to learn stuff.
Yeah.
It's actually crazy the advantage that we have. And it's crazy how many people don't use that advantage.
Right.
It's like astonishing. Like anything that you'd want to do. I mean, most of anything. There's a good chance there's going to be information out there on it, and like probably more information that you'll ever be able to fully, like, you'll never be able to read all of it. There's so much out there on a particular topic that you like doing.
Yeah.
Like building engines. There's just like, there's so much minutia and there's so many details. And you know, back the people that were actually back in the day, like figuring that all out in like the 40s, 50s, 60s, they had to just figure it out. And they still did a really good job at it.
Right, so it's just crazy. There was no YouTube. There was no Google.
No. So it's like super advantageous to be into anything in this information age.
Yeah. WikiHow.
I think that especially applies to people like us that live out kind of in the boonies, you know? To like, we don't necessarily have access to that talent that you could see in a city. But now, I guess now we do, you know,
yeah.
you don't have a private lesson, but if you have enough determination, you can learn all the same stuff.
Yep.
And you know,
whereas before it was not an option. And if you lived out here, you just got good at like farming or doing whatever they did out here.
Yeah.
Cutting down trees.
That's still kind of is the bread and butter for what I do. I definitely need people to keep doing that.
Right. Yeah. I don't think that'll ever really stop. I mean,
no, as long as we're going to keep wiping our ass with toilet paper, we'll still have a timber industry.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And it's a lot of people make it out to be like really bad for the environment, but it's not. It's generally pretty decent for the environment, especially if those as far as like carbon capture and whatnot.
Right.
If those trees are going towards building materials or something, all of that carbon that was in that tree is now being captured, and it's not being re-released into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
So it's
never
it's,
thought of it that way.
Yeah, it's actually pretty decent for like global emissions.
Can you name a better renewable resource?
I mean, water's a pretty
dams.
Dams, I mean, they've really messed up, like, the salmon populations. So, you know.
A resource that in itself is fundamentally useful. Like, I mean, water is a renewable resource, but water will renew itself without, you know, if we just cut trees down and didn't replant them, then it's, I mean, the tree is technically renewable, but the human intervention of replanting.
I see.
Right.
It's the most renewable resource. I mean, I'm sure that there's probably other examples, but there's nothing that you can make so many things out of that is so renewable and so plentiful. And there's, I mean, harvesting it has very little other than habitat damage, which you can't avoid. That's, you know, if you're cutting trees down, there are animals living in those trees, and they don't have a home anymore.
Right.
And that can't be avoided, but it can be mitigated.
Especially with these, like, farmed trees that they have, you know, like... Like, that's becoming, there's tons of tree farms out there that just...
Yeah, so a big thing on that is that there's a point in the tree's life where it stops, like, taking in as much carbon, like, as it used to. So it'll get to, like, 20 or 30 years, and that's when its growth rate will drop, like, drastically.
Sure. Wow.
So when you see, like, these giant old growth trees, that's kind of like, you know, hundreds of years of growth, and for every tree to get that big, it just wouldn't be worth it, because they wouldn't be depositing as much carbon.
And you can totally see that in, like, the growth rings. That's totally something you can literally visually see.
Yeah, you get a lot of tighter growth rings at the end of its life.
Absolutely. Kind of like how, like, you know, you grow until you're about 18 and then you quit growing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I didn't know that as trees got older that they, through photosynthesis, I believe is what that's called.
Yeah.
They convert carbon dioxide into oxygen.
Right. Yeah.
So they do less of that as they get older.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
So, I took forest ecology. Just a college course in forest ecology. And my professor said, basically, there are, you know, a few different types of forests. There's, like, old growth, new growth, man-made, and clear cut. And for us to have, like, the highest amount of ecological diversity, we need all of these types of forests, clear cut, man-made, new growth, and old growth, because there's certain species that only live in one particular type of forest. But the highest amount of ecological diversity, does anyone want to take a guess on which type of forest?
I'm going to say a clear cut.
Yep, it's a clear cut. So the reason is because it like almost literally levels the playing field for all different types of life to grow from that area.
Yeah. Right.
That's news to me.
So if you're going solely for ecological diversity, you just, like, chop everything down.
Do not replant. Replanting has the economic influence, though. I mean, you want to be able to harvest again in 40 years.
Yeah. And right. Yeah, like I said before, is we want man-made, we want new growth, we want old growth, and we do also want some clear-cut forests. Obviously, that all has to be regulated. We can't just go out and clear-cut everything in the world, but we do need clear-cuts.
One thing that has always kind of interested me is I don't know the best way to put it, but after a forest fire, how fertile a burned forest is.
Oh yeah.
It's like it's incredibly fertile. Do you know anything about that, Brady?
Say that again.
So like when a forest fire happens.
Oh right.
And a forest is, like, burned basically to, like, char and stumps. Or a lot of times the trees are still standing, but they're burning, like, internally for a long time.
Yeah.
It's crazy how, like, stuff that would have never grown in there before will start to grow because it's such a fertile environment with all the, basically activated carbon.
Yeah, so the bread and the butter of tree growth is like water, sunlight, and carbon. So when you have a burn, that's putting a lot of carbon into the ground, a lot of nutrients into the ground, and a lot of carbon into the surrounding air. So that gives trees like a big, big old meal to chew on and to suck in new carbon.
Yeah. No, that's really cool because, and another thing too is that, think about, I mean, when selective logging and, you know, let's say cutting 50 acres out of the woods, which is, I don't know what the standard logging operation is, or like you're, because some are bigger than others where they, you know, they buy the piece of property or they select it to be logged and then they actually clear cut it and replant it. I don't know what the median size and acreage is for like a typical operation. But you have to think about it in a percentage of how much of the rest of the United States or how much of the rest of the world is protected forest that is still going to produce a lot of oxygen and it is still, you know, it's not going to be affected by this one small operation. And it's crazy how far lumber really goes out of trees, like in board footage. You get a lot more lumber out of a tree than you think you would. Especially with like the like sawmilling technology and how like computers can calculate, you know, they can literally take like a sample and take a picture of the end of the log, and it'll say, okay, we can get a 2x4 here, 2x12 here,
yeah.
And they can very efficiently with almost no waste, you know, cut the rough dimensional lumber and then plane it, and one cool thing about wood is that like you don't waste anything. These sawmills, you know, when they plane them, they create a ton of shavings, and the shavings can be used for like
livestock,
multiple things.
Yeah.
I think they can be turned into pulp.
Yeah.
For paper, and it's just cool. It's a very renewable resource. We've been talking about trees for a while, though.
Yeah.
So
trees are really good as a carbon deposit, but they are not the best oxygenator of the world.
I think that possibly Brady Anderson over here might have some info.
Yeah.
On the most efficient oxygen producing organism / green stuff.
Yeah, what is it?
It's algae.
Lots of it.
That's right.
There's a lot of it in the ocean.
That's what.
What's the percentage of oxygen that it produces in the world? It's like, it's a percentage.
It's a big chunk. It's a big chunk.
Big chunk.
Yeah. I don't know specifically the number, but I think it's around 50%.
I 70% rings a bell for me. Yeah. That might have been on like some Instagram like totally real facts page.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's hard to I think it's also difficult to put into a percentage because all of this stuff they're just kind of estimates, right? So you're like, okay, well, trees probably produce about this much, and then foliage probably produces about this much if you, like, estimate the amount. And then algae, there's probably this many tons of biomass of algae, so they're going to produce this much. And, you know, it's all relatively, you're just estimating.
Yeah.
Right.
No one's gone out and counted every single, the amount of oxygen produced by every single plant, and then it's just impossible.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, well, is there anything else that you can add on like that subject? Because I kind of had something that I wanted to run by you guys. Just something I wanted to talk that I was thinking about today.
Yeah, what's that?
Unless one of you guys has something else to add to the algae topic, because algae is really interesting.
I mean, algae is really cool.
Algae is cool. There's a lot of it out there.
It's
kind of slimy and it's like fun to play with a stick.
Yeah, but it's also super important for like a food source.
Is algae a single-celled organism?
Ooh, dude. There's a lot of different kinds of algae. There's microalgae and there's also macroalgae. Microalgae is single-celled, but macroalgae is like kelp and seaweed.
Really?
Yeah, so kelp and seaweed are actually types of algae, but they're macroalgae, so they form structures with the cells, you know.
Kelp
news
and
to me.
Seaweed is not something that I would really have thought of as like an algae.
Not at all. That's mind-blowing.
Right. And there's also another classification that kind of gets thrown into algae, but it's a little bit different. It's called cyanobacteria. And that's bacteria that is producing, it's photosynthetic. So it's really just like, it's a bacteria like anything else, but it can produce its own energy from the sun, which is pretty wild, pretty wild.
Yeah.
They're also, cyanobacteria are also a lot, the cells are typically quite small, because it's a bacterium. So, yeah.
Where'd you get those pajama pants, Brady?
Oh, they were a Christmas present.
I really liked them. Very Christmassy.
Yeah.
They look like you're wearing candy canes on your legs.
Shockingly, I think they're Burt's Bees.
Burt's Bees makes clothes, huh?
Apparently.
Are they renewable? Are they made out of bee, honeybee fur?
I don't think so.
Dude, imagine.
That would probably
imagine something
really
made out
good.
Of honeybee fur. It was so soft.
I remember seeing a few years ago, these guys made like a blanket out of spider silk.
No,
spider
thank
webs.
You. You want to know something crazy about spider silk? You want to know something that's going to absolutely blow your mind about spider silk?
Sure.
Particularly Black Widow spider silk. So recently when I was in college about a couple years ago now, wow, that was a long time ago.
Don't think about it.
Yeah, no.
Don't think about
and
it.
And that's actually the topic that I was going to talk about later. It has to do with time passing.
Okay, yeah.
So when I was in college, we took a trip to Portland. It was a mandated. We all had to go. We had to like buy our own freaking hotel or like find some place to stay. It was kind of dumb. And we're all like broke tech school students.
Right, college kids.
Yeah.
So it was kind of lame, but I ended up, I stayed with Daniel, had some, my buddy Daniel. He had like an uncle and aunt that lived in Portland. So we stayed there and didn't drink anything at all. And we showed up to the tour at Leopold Scopes in Portland, not hungover. You're familiar with Leopold Scopes?
No.
They're a very, very high dollar rifle scope.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
It's actually pronounced Leupold, but I always pronounce it Leopold. It's spelled like L-E-U-P-O-L-D.
Yeah, that one.
German company that moved to the U.S. At some point. Actually, I think pre-World War II. I believe. I could be totally wrong, but I believe it's a German company. So we toured their facility. It was really cool. We had to give them they do contracting stuff for the military. So we had to show ID. We had to turn in our phones when we went in.
Oh yeah.
We had to like sticky note our phones with our names and turn them into a big box.
Yeah.
When we
sure.
walked into the facility.
They don't want you taking pictures or anything.
Nope, not at all. And the dirtiest, nastiest, greasiest corner of that machine shop you could probably eat off of.
Wow.
It was crazy. There were like probably at least 100 like German-made CNC machines, probably $1 million each, like in rows, and just like tons of people working, and it was really cool. But where the spider silk comes in, is that when they made the scopes back, probably pre-70s before they found a better technology, what they would actually use for the reticle, you know, your crosshairs.
Yeah.
They had several hundred Black Widow spiders. And they would farm their silk.
No.
And they would spool up the silk on yarn spools or like those thread spools. And every guy that was making scopes, they probably had a particular guy, but he would take a piece of that Black Widow silk and he would lay the reticle into the cutout.
That is wild.
So old, very, very old rifle scopes. By Leopold and probably other manufacturers are Black Widow silk, and that's your crosshairs. That's what the shooter is looking through is Black Widow silk,
which makes it like that much cooler, honestly.
Yeah, it is a very deadly spider.
Yeah.
So that goes back to the spider silk blanket. Only,
interesting.
I don't know. I almost think that the rifle scope is less uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I don't want to.
Wait, so did you have
And
anything?
It's very strong too. Spider silk I heard like that if you take like a strand of it, if you make it into a rope the thickness of a pencil, you can stop like a moving like what do you call those? Oh my gosh. Like a passenger plane.
Oh, a passenger plane.
Like full speed
wow.
passenger plane, you can like halt it with a a piece of spider silk that's braided into a rope the size of a pencil.
So what you're saying is the movie Spider-Man is actually, you know, it's not completely insane.
No, it's very strong. Everything in that movie is, other than it being a superhero movie, is very feasible in the web department.
Wow.
Wow. So what's this this time passing?
Okay, so I've been thinking about this recently. I don't want to ask you guys. Brady, you're 22, 23?
23 now.
You're fucking old.
Yeah, don't get me started.
And Cody and I are both 21. Ugh. But when you turn 20, you're young. You're young, right?
Yeah.
You turned 21 pretty recently.
Well, yeah.
A few months ago.
I'm 21 and a half, guys.
I'll be 22 here in February. And I hear from, like, what's really weird is if you think about, you know, from the time that, let's say you're like a 1-year-old baby,
yeah,
and then you grow up and you become 2 years old, like that's your like massive developmental stages. Literally half of your life has passed from the time you turn 1 to 2, and every year you get older, it's a smaller percentage of your life that's passed by.
Right.
So that's why people are like, oh, when you get older, it speeds up.
Right. Yeah.
Do you guys feel like your life is going by like, oh my gosh, where has my life gone? Or what do you feel about that?
No, not yet. I still feel like every year is just kind of dragging on, like, kind of ready to get it over with and
really?
Move on and yeah, move forward.
What about you, Bradskis?
That's such a tough question because in some ways I'm like, I have these goals that I want to accomplish. And so I'm like, okay, well, here's this goal. And I'm like, okay, well, I have to wait to accomplish this goal. You know, you can only make so much money at a time. So you like building a house or something, you know, I got to wait, save up money so I can afford a down payment so I can build a house.
Yeah, it doesn't happen overnight.
Right, exactly. But in other ways, I'm like, okay, well, I want to accomplish these goals. And time is ticking, right? So, like, it feels like the relative distance between these goals, it keeps getting longer. Like when you're young, you're like, okay, I made it out of middle school, right? Oh, and then every year you graduate. Well, you graduate from that, you know, grade, and you're like, okay, now I'm on to the next grade. And it only takes a year between each thing, right?
Yeah.
But once you get past that, you kind of have to make your own graduations, so to speak. You know?
I see exactly what you mean by that.
Yeah.
You know, you got to set goals for yourself.
Right. And so I think depending on how you set your goals, that can kind of change how fast time is going for you in some ways, you know?
I do know. And that's kind of what it seems like to me. Is that, like, I hear people that are like, they're like 30 and they're like, oh man, it's just like everything, it's just flown by, you know, like, oh, I was your age like yesterday.
Yeah.
I don't know. I still have a lot of growing to do and like getting older to do. But I feel like, what you said about setting goals, what I feel like is that the more that you like occupy your mind and that the more that you, like try every day to like learn stuff and like you really try to be like better than you were the day previous, because there are people that are our age that, and every age, but there are a lot of people of our age, in the Gen Z category that, like they work a job that doesn't provide them any knowledge. It just provides them like, you know, a basic income.
Compensation.
Yeah. Compensation for selling your hours.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, like, a lot of people work jobs that are like, I mean, everyone has to start somewhere, but like food service, like you don't learn anything really. There's only so much like moving up you can do.
Yeah. And people are content there.
Yeah. Some people are content with that, which is cool. I mean, I can't begin to like, it's in no way like discrimination on anyone, because everyone's got to start somewhere, and likely they don't want to like be in that. What'd you drop, Cody?
I threw my phone across the room there.
Oh, well, it's a Samsung, so it's probably broken.
Nah,
I love Samsungs, to be honest.
Pelican case.
I'm on the, ooh, I got a, what are those called? the Otterbox yeah. Defender, because nice. I don't want my charging port to break like my last one did.
Yeah.
But anyway, I feel like the more not turmoil, but the more uncertainty and challenge in your life, the more every day you like appreciate like every, you know, every hour of challenge. And like, if you're always challenging yourself, I feel like time goes by slower because you have to like cognitively perceive things in a different way. And you have to like think harder about things. And I feel like I'm a lot older than the age that I am. I feel like time goes by really slow.
Yeah.
It's really weird. It's like, how am I 21? It's kind of strange. It's like a strange phenomenon for me. Yeah, I don't know if you guys felt the same about that.
That's exactly how I've been feeling.
Really?
Like every day is kind of just dragging on.
Yeah. It drags on. I mean, in a way, but it just seems like, especially like with what we all do, all three of us pretty much, we have like relatively challenging careers in their own respect.
Sure,
yeah. None of us are playing the game really on easy mode.
Right.
I mean, my life's not too bad. I'm pretty, like, my stuff is pretty, it's not easy, but it's like, it's not super stressful and really, but it is challenging, like cognitively. And your guys' stuff is probably like, Cody's stuff is probably very, in a lot of ways, more challenging in certain ways because you're dealing with way different things that anyone else really deals with.
Yeah. So part of that though is I have a partner. So anything that I don't know, my partner probably knows, and anything my partner doesn't know, I probably know. So we can rely on each other a lot for that sort of stuff. But I think the emotional aspect of it is something that a lot of people don't get.
Because I don't get it.
Yeah.
I couldn't begin, like the stuff you described to me, it's so hard to comprehend going through something like that and having just, okay, it's part of the job.
Yeah, and that's really what it boils down to, is it has to be kind of just a part of the job. Yeah, if you get too attached, then it could get really hard.
Right. Does that particular occupation, is that a big driving force of like feeling like things are going slowly? And because it seems like you've been doing it for how long now?
6 months.
6 months, okay. But have you been into medicine longer than that?
Yeah, so I have been an EMT for over a year, and I've been a first responder for 2 years now, almost 2 years.
Okay, so there are people that are probably in their 30s or 40s, and they have just became an EMT or something.
Right.
So for your age, and for, 'cause obviously when you're young, you absorb things so much better. And you learn on a way different scale than someone trying to learn it once they've already spent their life learning other things. Does it feel, it's like, wow, I'm 21 and I'm working with these people and I'm so deep into this.
Yeah.
And I'm only 21.
Yeah.
Does it ever feel like that?
So a lot of my coworkers are they're getting up there in their ages, you know, 40s, 30s and 40s. So it's kind of weird to be, you know, so young and doing this. But there's people who are younger than me who are doing the same thing, you know. 18 and 19-year-olds. So.
Gotcha. Brady, do you work with, I mean...
I'm definitely the youngest, not the youngest person that I work with, but the youngest person in my position that I work with.
Right.
Yeah.
And your pay grade.
Oh, yeah, exactly. The youngest person in my pay grade.
Nothing to be ashamed of, my friend.
Oh, no. But I do experience kind of what you're talking about, Ryan, where you're like, you're working with people that are all older than you, and you're, in some ways, you feel like I should be a lot older than I am.
Yes.
in this position. And I think that leads to something that Cody has talked to me about.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit of imposter syndrome, where you're like, whoa, like, should I be here? And what did I do? And do I really belong here? What do these people see in me that makes me belong here, you know?
I didn't know that there's a name to that.
Yep, imposter syndrome.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is that something you have ever, like, experienced or dealt with?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Because, I mean, without getting too into detail, yes. I deal with that pretty frequently because I'm, with what I do with engines, I'm going on forums and, like, reading stuff. And these guys that are, like, in their 50s. They're, like, these white dudes in their 50s that are doing this with like, saw engines and, like motorcycle engines. And some of them have, like, engineering degrees. And they're talking about, not fluid dynamics, but, like, dynamics of air and
yeah.
Oh, sure.
Like, minutia stuff. I can't put a name to all of it because it's just, like, there's not a name to all of it. It's just, like, you're working on engines and making them, like, more efficient. But it's weird. I'm in this game and I'm doing all this stuff and I'm like, man, I got into this when I was really young. I'm glad that, like, I put my eggs in this basket, I guess. I mean, there are probably better things I could have done, but I really enjoy doing it. And it's like, it's the funnest thing ever for me.
Yeah.
And, imposter syndrome is a really interesting. I've maybe heard of that name, but I didn't know, like, the background to, like,
sure,
the definition,
yeah,
of it.
Right.
And, it's like, it's just crazy. Like, I'm without, like, getting too into detail or being, like, sounding boastful, which I try not to do. It is really interesting how you can feel like, why am I in this position and why do I have this importance? Like, I'm just like a kid, just, like, fucking around and,
yeah,
and playing with engines and, like, doing what I enjoy doing. And it's all about, like, channeling and marketing stuff correctly. Not like marketing is like, as in like selling, but like being able to do stuff that's marketable.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Like
having
what you
skill,
do.
Having a skill.
Having a skill unlike what you do, where there's such a demand for it, but it's such a nerdy, like, I'm calling you a nerd, by the way.
Oh,
You're correct. It's like a super, it's something that no one else can really do without schooling and without, like, all the proper prerequisites.
Right.
And you're like, you probably love doing it. All right. I hope you do.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I have my moments where I'm like, oh, but usually that comes from, like, it comes from the stress of just, like, working with people. And, you know, people aren't perfect, and so you come across things that are, you guys have all experienced this, because, I mean, both of you guys.
Yeah.
This is especially common in like shops.
Yeah.
Right.
Where you're like, okay, you bring your machine in, whatever. You drop it off. You ask for something and then you don't hear back. You're like, okay,
right,
I guess they're working on it. And then you don't hear back and you're like, hey, did you ever get around to that thing?
Yeah.
And then they're like, oh yeah, that thing, yeah, it's we're doing it. And then two days later they're like, oh yeah, it's done.
Oh
right.
You know what I'm saying? So I guess that's the only aspect of my job where I'm like, you know, it's just being well organized and making sure that you're staying on top of everything,
not having to be reminded of your tasks.
Yeah
I'm with you on that. And what I can say on that phenomenon, which is, you know, having worked in retail repair shop environments.
Right. Yeah.
Is that usually they're pretty well organized. I mean, at least the ones that I've worked in, the two that I've worked in in a dealership settings, they're usually pretty well organized. I mean, unless they're not, I mean, some of them just kind of aren't, but, for the most part, stuff just takes a long time sometimes. And a lot of it, too, is that there are people, like, ahead of you, which is just part of how it goes.
Right, yeah.
And a lot of times stuff does fall through the cracks.
Right.
And a lot of that is on the individual technician.
Sure.
Right.
I tried my best to not have that stuff happen. But sometimes, like, and it's different with the people. Like, if they tell you, it's going to be, you should be getting a phone call within 2 weeks. And you don't get a phone call within 2 weeks, you have every reason to call.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And the squeaky wheel gets the grease.
In a way, or the squeaky wheel pisses off the technician.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's true. Sometimes
if they're too squeaky. But if they're squeaky in the right respect, then it could get the grease. But a lot of times in like a shop setting, with my shop setting stuff being limited, sometimes stuff gets like skipped ahead. It's like, oh, you know this guy and it should be a quick job, and it gets skipped ahead. And even though this other person's been waiting longer and waiting patiently, they get skipped over, and it's just kind of part of the dynamic.
Yeah.
But for the most part,
the human dynamic.
That's part of, yeah. I mean, the world is the human dynamic.
Yeah.
It's crazy the impact that the human dynamic has on the entire world and like everything, and
right.
like the environment, and how everything has to work around us pretty much.
Yeah.
Because we're just so much better than every other species.
Yeah. I think as I get older, that's something that I respect a lot more. Whereas I used to think that there was a lot more of an analytical answer to everything. And now that I'm getting older, I'm realizing that there's the human element plays a much bigger impact than I originally thought.
Yeah, absolutely.
In regards to everything, you know, like at the end of the day, people are making all the decisions. And so you have to play into that in some regards to get what you need. You know, there are people making these decisions, and they're influenceable in some ways, you know.
The more I think about the human element and the impact that, like, and very, very often not the positive impact that humans have on the rest of the world,
sure.
Which, you know, I mean, before human, like not human evolution, but, like, human industriousness and where people started to actually, like, you know, colonize and like start modifying the world around them for their advantage. The more I think about how, what if that never happened? Like, what would the world around us be if humans never were industrious, or if we never decided that we need cars, or that we need all these things to make our lives work. And like what if, it's just crazy. I mean, there's be animals everywhere, obviously. And the more that it's kind of weird because I'm a moderate to conservative person politically. And for the most part, I don't know, not politically, but like not socially, but, like in your way of thinking generally.
Sure. Yeah.
I'm typically like on the moderate to maybe a little bit on the right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But honestly, the more I think about the human impact on the world, and I am like by no means remotely like very far on the left, but like it's kind of a weird topic. But like, think about how many animals we kill just so we can like feed ourselves.
Right, it's weird.
And I mean, hunting's cool. Hunting is like hunting is obviously a whole different thing than like factory farming. But like the more that I think about the human element and like the human impact on the rest of the world, the more I kind of like almost think that I have like a lot more left-leaning mindset.
Well, I think that comes with the territory of thinking about the human impact. I think that's something that people on the left tend to think about a lot more than people on the right, you know.
Right, and I'm incredibly all for you know, economic progress
right.
above anything else. I mean, because that brings like happiness, and that brings like happy brain chemicals to humans.
Right.
And then going the other direction doesn't. So, you know, humans are naturally hedonistic, and they're going to always want to pursue things that make them feel good. And typically like industriousness and progress, like economically and in industry, is good because it makes everyone more comfortable. If we can, you know, the more things that we do industrially and the more products we make, it just makes everyone's life easier. But there is a totally real downside to all of it, and it's primarily like economic impact.
Right.
And it seems like the more you think about it, the more you can, I mean, at least from my point of view, because I'm all for it, but at the same time, when I really think about it, it's like, well, yeah, we're humans, and we're, you know, we're like intellectually superior to every other species, but who are we to do this?
Yeah.
Even though, like, I would never, when I really think about it, that's how I get, but, you know, even though I'm never going to politically think that way. because I'm all about like economic progress.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that it's important to have balance in that regard, you know?
Totally.
Like if we just let people run over the environment, that would be bad. But if we just completely cut off manufacturing and everything, that would also be really bad.
Because, be very inconvenient.
Well, yeah, but not only that, but people would starve. You know, people would die. There would be people dying.
Yeah, same with GMOs.
Yeah, that's another big thing.
Yeah.
That's a huge moral, not moral, in a way, moral, like, dividing factor.
Yeah. Of people. It feeds a lot of people. And if we just cut them out, then...
Well, and the GMOs are also tricky because if you think about, in a way, GMOs are just speeding up a natural process. Yeah. I mean, take a look at farming. So, like, corn came from maize, right? And through selection of certain strains of maize that were bigger and better and they were tastier.
Artificial selection via...
Through farming and
humans,
right. It's just happened over thousands of years. We were able to, you know, select better and better strains of maize to eventually get to corn, and no one has a problem with that. Like, you never hear anyone complaining about corn or bananas. You know, bananas are the same sort of situation where they were selected by humans to become sweet and tasty.
Yeah. Right.
No one has a problem with that. But as soon as you speed that process up, then people are like, whoa, 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 whoa. There's something weird going on here. And to some degree, I've heard studies like with rice production. Where some strains of rice, they're able to grow really quickly, but then the amount of like minerals and nutrients that you're getting from each grain of rice is becoming less, and so there's certainly trade-offs to be made there.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah.
Do you have any opinions on the downside of artificial selection, Cody? Because I can think of a good example that kind of showcases how it's definitely not always a good. It's very rarely a good thing. In a lot of ways, it can be good for humans. Do you have any?
Not that comes to mind immediately.
So you guys are familiar with the English bulldog?
Oh my gosh!
Yeah.
Oh.
At one point back thousands of years ago, or tens of thousands, however long ago, that was a wolf, a super healthy, athletic, like dominant creature, in the food chain, and because humans wanted them to be dumb looking. They kept breeding the ugly ones. I don't know. You can't really trace it all. But and then we end up with this dog that they're very cute, but they have enormous health problems.
Right.
You have to take them to the vet every 2 months and spend $3,000 on them. And they're like in misery, like living, but people like love them and they want to have them and they'll pay a bunch of money for them.
Yeah, I see what you're saying now.
And that's just strange to me. Is that like, who are we to decide that?
Yeah, that is true. Humans produce abominations, but
they're cute though.
I think it's also important to note that the environment creates some abominations as well. Natural selection also produces some horrible creatures that just like, how are you still in existence?
Like what?
Like football fish.
Football fish. Yeah.
Wolf eels or wolf-headed eels. These things are disgusting.
But they're
probably predators, and they probably have a very sustainable. They can probably like live off their own environment readily.
But they're ugly.
But English bulldogs are cute.
I mean, okay. Here's an example, and I'm probably speaking out of turn in some ways. I'm sure that this creature is somehow more fit than it appears on its face. But pandas.
Oh yeah, pandas are. They evolved in such a negative way.
Yeah, that's very, very true. Pandas didn't have a very good hand of cards.
It's impossible to get them to breed. Even in the wild, I think they struggle to breed. And then they have a single food source. They only eat bamboo, right? So it's,
yeah, because they evolved to eat bamboo because it contains arsenic. So they had to evolve to be able to eat it.
Right, which doesn't make sense. I don't understand how... I'm sure there's a great explanation out there of how pandas came to be, but no one's explained that
to me. It's the same with koalas, koala bears.
Yeah, they only eat eucalyptus leaves, don't they? Yeah.
Which is poisonous.
Yes, and to ready their stomachs for eucalyptus leaves, they have to feed their offspring their own shit.
Dude!
Yeah. So their offspring eats their shit so that they can also eat eucalyptus leaves.
Damn nature. Blowing it.
Yeah, so there are creatures out there that, like, natural selection has produced as well that are just... They have every right to go extinct, honestly. Like, and I know that sounds harsh. I know that sounds really harsh, and we're probably going to catch a lot of flack for that. But, like, they just don't make sense. And
right.
There's probably some sort of situation where a long time ago they had a different food source, and then something happened to that food source. That's
humans?
It could be. I don't know enough to speak on that.
Me neither.
Not sure.
I don't know very much.
But then that food source went extinct, and they're forced or evolved in a way that they can no longer eat it. And so now they're stuck with, you know, this outrageous food source that doesn't make any sense, and their breeding doesn't make any sense, and they're fat and slow, so that just not very fit. Like, none of it makes sense.
Not escaping predators very well.
Yeah.
Like sloths. They're...
Oh, my. Yep.
Sloths
there's another...
That's a great example.
A failure of natural selection.
Sloths are useless.
What a stupid creature.
I know.
You know, they grab their own arms as they're climbing, and they think it's a tree branch, and then they fall to their death.
That's documented.
That's a real thing.
That's a real thing.
I've heard that. I don't know if that was a totally true Instagram fact.
They have to climb down the tree to take a deuce.
Really? They don't just let it drop?
No.
No.
They climb down the tree. And it takes them hours.
So the entire time a cheetah could come and consume them.
Well, I don't think a cheetah. I don't think that's the same environment. But
are you sure?
Well, I could be wrong.
We need to look into that.
Yeah,
some kind of feline type mammal that would eat.
Yeah,
yeah,
some sort of predator.
Some sort of predator. You know where?
And what? Sorry, but I'm gonna cut in here.
Do it.
Before we get off sloths. I think this is sloths. Is it sloths?
Go ahead.
I might be wrong. Square poop.
Oh, I don't know.
What? I think I've heard something like that.
It might not be sloths. It's another one of those creatures that it's like, how did, what,
why?
It might be koalas, actually.
I think it's koalas. Sure.
It might be koalas.
That sounds
how
more...
How did that happen?
Dude, I don't know. Like, I can't even begin to comprehend how that would happen.
Yeah. And there's also
Minecraft.
Like a platypi. I mean, that's an abomination as well, but at least it
yeah,
has
what
its...
even is that? Is it technically the only...
mammal that lays eggs.
Yep.
They're bizarre, but they have a niche, you know, like they serve a niche in the environment,
right?
Like they're thriving within their, well, maybe not thriving, I don't know the endangered status of platypi, but you know, they make some sense.
They have
in their environment.
They have their place.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know where I think the natural selection hit out of the park, like a really really cool animal. That's, like, perfect in every way and, like, cute. Freaking lemurs.
Ooh, lemurs are adorable. Yeah.
Lemurs are so awesome. Like, you cannot... I mean, some of them are kind of creepy looking. But they're, like, they're so cool and they're super athletic and they can escape predators really well. And they pretty much live in... Don't they just live on that island?
I don't know.
That island off of...
There's multiple...
Madagascar.
There's
the movie.
Right. There's multiple species of lemur, right? There's like the ring-tailed lemur.
Oh, there's a bunch.
There's like a, yeah.
They're very diverse, I believe. There's like there's probably dozens at least of varieties. And they're, I mean, what bad can you say about them? They're like more adorable than any like human bred dog, maybe. And yeah. They're like agile, quick little guys, run around. They're, I don't know what their diet is, but it's probably very plentiful. And they're like cool. They're probably not going extinct anytime soon.
Yeah. You should look at, after the podcast, you should look at the animal, a kinkajou.
Oh,
those are
adorable.
A kinky what?
Absolutely, yeah. A kinkajou. And someone's going to comment on this and be like, hey, that's not how you pronounce that. But that's how it's spelled.
I think so.
I'm pretty sure it is. Kinkajou. And they've got these super long, like, flexible tails that they can wrap around things.
Oh.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Didn't you kind of like want to get one at one point?
Yeah, I think they're just some really fascinating animals. I'm not sure what the legality on owning them is. I'm sure you have to have some sort of permit to be able to own a kinkajou.
It might depend on the state also, because like Texas, you can own tigers, and there's just nothing against. There's no laws governing tigers in Texas.
Right.
So
all the lawmakers had them.
Yeah,
you're not giving out their damn tigers. You're keeping those.
Tiger King.
Yeah.
Never watched that.
Neither
Everyone
did
told
I.
me to, and I really don't think I have time for that.
Honestly. It's like watching a train wreck.
Did you watch it?
I watched a couple of the episodes.
Yeah. Yeah. Fun fact. Little known, but actually, I think most people know this at this point. There's more tigers in the state of Texas, privately owned, than there are in the entire wilderness.
What?
I'm pretty sure that's true.
I've heard that before.
That is freaking wild.
That's crazy, huh?
No,
I mean,
it's domestic.
Yeah, that doesn't. Yeah, that's really funny, Cody.
Thank you.
But that doesn't seem like too far off of a. That's probably totally feasible.
Yeah, I mean,
it's just fascinating. The stuff that humans do could be really surprising, but it's like, of course they did that.
right. I think, you know, Mike Tyson had a bunch of tigers as well. I don't think he has them anymore, but maybe.
The Hangover?
The Hangover. Right.
Doesn't Usain Bolt own like a cheetah?
Well, that's what he said.
That's what he said.
In order to prepare for his record-winning race,
tie a bunch of pork chops to himself and run from it.
He'd race his cheetah.
No, he said he raced it once.
Oh, okay.
He said he raced it once, and then and that's how he became a legend.
Did he beat it?
Of course. Yeah. Of course.
Yeah.
Well, it probably depends on how motivated the cheetah was, right? You know,
yeah.
I think they're pretty unmotivated in general.
You have to be if you're a predator.
Cheetahs are also kind of another bizarre, like, they fill such a specific niche. You know, like, they've developed to catch antelope, and that's pretty much it.
That's
right?
It, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're like, oh, we need to get really fast so we can chase down these antelope, and then...
I think you're right on me being wrong on the cheetah and koala being in the same, or sloth being in the same environment. I think I'm thinking of like a
jaguar or something.
An ocelot.
Oh, an ocelot. Yeah. Do you think an ocelot could take out a sloth? Probably.
Ocelots are pretty small, aren't they?
Yeah.
Aren't they like between like a big cat and like a house cat?
Yeah, maybe like lynx size.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
But probably most things could take down a sloth, honestly. Sloths get taken out by harpy eagles. Harpy eagles swoop into the trees and take out sloths.
Harpy eagles are huge.
Right.
They have, like, the biggest talons. Sorry, it just reminded me of a movie there.
What?
Say the quote.
You say it. I can't remember it exactly. It's like,
do your chickens have large talons?
Oh, okay. Yeah. That movie.
Yeah, that's it.
Does he say chickens? Maybe it's not chickens, but oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's it.
That's a good movie.
Napoleon Dynamite.
Yep.
Large talons.
The
we used to quote that all the time. Oh my gosh.
Wow, I
that
don't
movie.
Understand a word you just said.
Oh, and he becomes like the best in FFA. Wait, Pedro. Yeah. He's like a master of FFA, and he can like tell.
No, it was Napoleon. He drank the milk and he could tell exactly which cow it came from.
Yeah. He was like, that cow got into a cabbage patch or something like that. Oh my gosh. That movie is legendary. Cult classic.
Cult classic for sure. You know what's funny about that movie? That movie has the highest, I think it was the highest profit rate. Like the ratio of what it costed to produce to the profits that it made.
Sure.
Because it costed nothing to produce.
I'm sure.
It had the highest, differential of like any movie ever, I think. Because it was literally so low budget and it was so popular.
That makes sense. I mean, what...
Unmatched.
What could they have spent money on that movie? Except for, like, the Tupperware that Uncle Rico runs over, you know? Like, gosh, man.
Maybe, like, the dune buggy when they're in the sand dunes or whatever.
Maybe.
Oh,
but right.
It's, like, the very beginning.
You'd think that maybe someone had one.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I think that movie was, like, $20,000 to produce. I don't know the number, but it was, like, some... super, super low amount of money.
Sure. Yeah.
Broke my cockyx. Is that what she says? Is that what she says?
Oh, God.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember a quote. It's been a little while since I've seen that one. God, it's a hilarious movie, though. It's like the best deadpan humor movie ever.
Eat the food, Tina!
You guys just spitting out the quotes, and I can't think of one.
Dude,
oh, man.
I'm lacking on the Napoleon in my quotes tonight.
Napoleon, just let me borrow your chapstick.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah, that's what it is.
Imagine a million seahorses floating all around you.
I can't think of any. I feel like an idiot.
Just make yourself a dang quesadilla. Oh, there's so many good ones. Sharks, pegs, lucky.
Plane,
you got like
jealous.
3 feet of air right there. That's my contribution.
You're just jealous because I've been on the internet talking to hot babes all day.
What was his...
Nunchuck skills. Computer hacking skills.
Girls like guys that have great skills. This is turning into the quote podcast.
I was the one with the... He was like somewhere. He was like, I was in Alaska hunting wolverines.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
12 gauge. What do you think?
What'd you do this summer, Napoleon?
Yeah.
I told you already. This was my uncle hunting wolverines in Alaska. Yeah. Oh my gosh. I could throw this football over the mountains. Oh man.
Yeah. Well.
A very unique, like, there's no other movie like that.
No. Yeah. It's so unique.
It's so unique. It's something about it is like really comforting because it's so humble.
True. Yeah. I think you can, it's one of those movies that, this is going to sound slightly weird, but you can reach out and touch it, you know?
Yeah,
totally. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
You can reach out and touch it like it's right there in front of you. Like, everyone knows someone that's kind of like Napoleon, you know, like, just kind of weird off the tracks, but he's also so lovable.
So relatable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In a way. Right. Didn't we have a music teacher in middle school that was closely related to the actor that played Napoleon Dynamite?
I want to say she was his grandmother.
Yeah, I think his grandma lived in Squim, right?
Yeah,
I think that's
taught in Port Angeles.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
I remember hearing that back then, and I was like, oh, cool.
Yeah, Jeremy Heater is his name.
Gotcha.
Yeah. There's other people that are also... Well... It's always their grandparents, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Retirement community, what are you going to do?
Oh, Squim.
Well, you know, just the area, the peninsula.
Pretty much. Mostly Squim, though.
Squim and, like, Port Townsend. Port Townsend's pretty, the median age in Port Townsend's pretty old as well.
Port Townsend's an interesting place.
It is an interesting place. It's very hippie, but, like... It's an interesting community for sure.
Totally. Cody, what are you grabbing, buddy? Oh, your juice. Juicing up.
Yeah, you know, we were talking about wolverines, and that's an animal that done it right when it came to evolution.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I love wolverines.
Oh, yeah.
I wrote a when I was like in third grade, I wrote a presentation about Wolverines because I was so into them.
That makes sense. I mean, what is there not to be into when it comes to Wolverines?
They will kill moose slash elk. I think that that's more. I think they don't. I don't know if they live around one or the other, but they will literally take down like animals that are like 10 times their size.
Oh yeah, they'll scare away bears.
Yeah, bears
scare away a grizzly bear.
Grizzly bear.
Well, I from the bear's perspective, it makes sense as well because like. Wolverines are so vicious, they'll take you out, and they don't even care if they go down as well. So they're just going to take you out.
Wolverine don't care.
What I was saying earlier is we were talking about like the motivation of a cheetah.
Sure.
And I said if you are a predator, you have to be unmotivated because you don't want to get hurt. If you break a leg as a predator, like GG, guys, you're
going to
starve.
It.
You're someone else's food now. So, yeah, so Wolverine, like, they've got those big claws, and if they, you know, they scratch a bear's eye, he's dead.
Potentially, yeah. If it gets infected and, like, you know.
Yeah, that'd be pretty rough for that bear.
Yeah. And embarrassing.
Embarrassing.
Ah,
oh, my God.
That was terrible.
That was very bad.
Yeah.
Cody, what are you doing there? Oh, are you wiping up your...
Wiping up.
A little maintenance there.
So, yeah.
Well, yeah. What do you guys think? How's this going so far?
Pretty good.
Yeah. We covered a wide range of topics.
We did. And we are an hour and 26 minutes in.
That's a good first episode.
That's a great first episode.
Think so?
The entire thing seemed, all the way through seemed very, like, natural.
Do you guys want to listen to it back?
Let's do it. I don't see it needing to be any longer.
Yeah, let's cut it.
For a pilot.
Yeah.
I'm pretty pleased. What do you think, Cody?
I don't know. I don't know if I'm convinced that this is first episode quality yet.
Yeah.
Just because, I don't know. I think I would like to have... We'll discuss it. We'll listen back and discuss it.
Yeah, and if we listen to it back now, we have time to.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not very late yet.
No.
We're not pushing midnight.